Today we're Ball Noguez Studio in downtown Los Angeles with Mr. Ben Ball, one half of the Ball Noguez Studio. Ball Noguez Studio is an integrated design and fabrication practice. Benjamin grew up in Colorado and Iowa with a mother who was very, very involved in theater. And though she was an actress, Ben began to be fascinated by set design, set building, and the immediacy of that craft where a concept became reality. You could call Ben an architect, a designer, a conceptualist, but I think he's much, much more. In his current collaboration with Gaston Noguez, he's exploring the intersection of architecture, art, and product design. A major goal of his design endeavors is to create experiences. Because of this, he feels that, quote, a building that is not built is not architecture. But let's not go on too much about all this. Let's let Ben speak for himself.
We're talking to him a lot.
All right.
Start.
Okay. Let's do it.
Well, we're here with Mr. Ben Ball of the Ball Noguez Studio. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your studio, 410 South Spring Street in downtown Los Angeles.
410 South Spring Street. Well, that's a great question. When I first moved to LA, 410 South Spring Street was the place, the kind of the neighborhood where you didn't go.
Right. And even seven years ago, you wouldn't go there.
Right, right.
Maybe
right.
Even five, probably.
Right, that's right. We're very lucky to have a very spacious studio, which informs the type of work that we do to a degree. I think that that's something that's characteristic of LA, that when you have a lot of space, you can do, doing what I do, you can do more. You can do different things that I would never have dreamed of if I was in, say, for example, a small office space.
So let's, great. For the audience, what do you do? what do you and Gaston do in that space?
We're a design and fabrication practice. That's very loosely a loose definition of what we do. Some people would call it installation art. Some people would call it architecture, temporary architecture. I'd call it a kind of a combination of both. I think that we're interested in making things of a particular scale, kind of the scale of architecture, and doing it in any kind of venue that will give us the opportunity to do it.
Describe some of your recent projects so we can have a little more, you know, detail about this.
Well, right now we have a project we just completed for the Museum of Contemporary Art. It's at the PDC MoCA space, which is a large gallery. It's an installation. It's called Feathered Edge. What we were dealing with in this was trying to create kind of architectural effects, architectural space, using almost no material, if that makes any sense. So in this case, it was string, 22 miles of string that have been cut into 3,600 lengths of individual strings, and then they're suspended in what's called a catenary, which is an arch when you suspend a chain or a string between two points. We developed software with a computer programmer to design this. We developed a machine to cut it. It's a project that's kind of addresses some topics in architecture, but is not really a building per se. It has qualities of being an artwork, but it's also highly concerned with craft. It came out of an interest that the curator Brooke Hodge had in the convergence of computation and craft. MoCA has put together a series of installations that will be happening in the PDC space that address that convergence.
What's the value of this sort of exploration? Where is this? Where does the information that's garnered or the exploration go?
Where does it go? Well,
who cares about this?
And yeah, who cares
about
it?
In a non-respectful way, but I mean, who are the people who are concerned with what comes out of these explorations?
I mean, on the one hand, you know, I talk about it in terms of craft. I talk about it in terms of its relationship to architecture, but it doesn't really have to be understood on those terms. It should be. We always aim to make projects that can be appreciated on their own terms,
on an artistic level,
on an aesthetic level, on an artistic level, and require no background in design, no background in art, no background in architecture. You can go and you can look at the works and say, "Wow,
this is spectacular,
intriguing, or terrible, whatever you want."
But the exploration the process that gets you there is quite involved.
It's
very,
very involved, right.
And that's valuable unto itself.
Yes.
So.
I mean, I wouldn't say that we're not after contributing to public knowledge in the sense of being like, you know, maybe being an academic or something,
right,
where you would you know, your work is then published in a an academic journal, and the, you know, and you're sharing that knowledge and you're contributing to the field in that sense. But I think it's a personal interest of ours. But it also, I think it also is intended as a critique of kind of experimental architectural practice. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it is kind of serving a purpose. But that's, again, that is one interest that we have in the work among many.
Right. You've gone on record as saying that architecture that isn't realized is not really architecture. So what is it when it's not realized?
It's speculation. It's
speculation.
I mean, it's in the world of ideas, and I mean, architecture is always in the world of about ideas.
Right.
I just happen to think that saying that is a little bit like saying a screenwriter is not a filmmaker, right?
Right.
I mean, because a screenplay is not a film.
No,
so
it's a blueprint.
It's a blueprint, and it's often the term blueprint is often used to describe a screenplay. And so, by the same token, blueprints of a building are not a building. And I sometimes just feel as though within the field that of architecture that the kind of the experimental reaches of architecture, that it's always not, that little factoid is not always addressed.
Right.
Because I believe that a building, a space, is something that should be experienced with your body, should be experienced with your eyes, should be experienced with your ears, with your sense of touch, through time, through movement, versus as drawings, as models. I think that they're fundamentally different experiences.
Right.
And so making that distinction in my case is kind of a provocation in a way. It's also kind of, it's kind of a way to contribute or to kind of provoke the discourse
right.
around design.
And of course, I mean, you know, unfortunately for designers, I mean, to realize their work sometimes involves millions, if not billions
right.
of dollars.
Right, right, right.
So it's not that anybody's hesitant, because I'm certain that most
right.
designers would love to see their work realized.
Right. Of course, yeah. Yes. And that's a very good point. By saying that, I don't mean to dismiss the work of unrealized work. What I do hope that people do, though, is begin to see the potential in using lower cost materials, and it's especially for students in actually making spaces that they can inhabit, mm-hmm. Where they can test out their ideas in the same way that I suppose that if a filmmaker early in their career would do short films
right.
versus making, you know, the latest Michael Bay. I mean, that's kind of what it is. I mean, I suppose that's one of the things that was a response to
right.
was that in, you know, we're still kind of fairly closely associated with academia. And so you see within schools a tendency to design the blockbuster.
Right.
And our kind of response to that is, well, why not design something that can be actually constructed tomorrow, or, you know, you can begin constructing it tomorrow,
yes.
which will express some of your ideas versus, you know, kind of always making the Michael Bay blockbuster feature, which will never be realized.
Right.
It kind of,
but it's a beautiful dream all the same.
It's a beautiful dream, and it keeps you from it, but it also makes you immune from a certain type of criticism because you never have to actually contend with people's response to the work.
In this provocative stance of yours, I mean, have you gotten into like heated dialogue with people?
I always say that I get asked about it once in a while, but
well,
I think
after
the
this
people,
show, you're going to have more trouble.
Yeah, probably. I get asked about it, but I think that it's, like I said, it's not a dismissal of what's, you know, considered called paper architecture.
Right.
It's more from our standpoint, architecture, what's driving the work in many ways, what's provoking us to go out there and actually build something for, you know, 18 hours a day for 3 weeks straight when we do this kind of work is a desire and a belief in physical space to kind of be an experience that is worth having, you know, versus architecture purely being about instead of an intellectual discussion entirely.
So tell me about your other work. Tell me about what happened at PS1 and how that all arose.
PS1 is a competition that's held each year and sponsored by the Museum of Modern Art.
In New York.
In New York. where they ask curators and academics and magazine editors to nominate various young architecture practices to compete for a project in the PS1 courtyard to that serves as a backdrop for their warm-up music series, which is a Saturday music series.
And PS1 is a satellite in Queens.
It's a satellite.
What's the building like?
Well, it's a school. It was originally a school.
Literally PS1.
Literally PS1, built around, I guess, in the 19th century. And then in the 70s, Alana Heiss, who's the founder of the institution, acquired the building. And it was always intended to be a kind of laboratory for the production of work, contemporary work, versus, say, MoMA's seems to be more concerned with the historically, looking at work historically, cataloging it, placing it in a historical context, a larger cultural context, versus PS1 is about kind of making these things happen today.
And then your project in the courtyard, how was that manifested and how was that received?
Well, what we aim to do there, our approach was to use a material that we've been interested in, which is a colored translucent mylar, to create a kind of a ceiling over the space.
This is called Liquid Sky, which I love the name. I love the reference.
The reference, I suppose, is after the 1982 movie. And I saw the scene happening underneath
an alien who thrives on chemicals released at the time of orgasm.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead and say that.
Yeah, you can. You've said it.
I've already said it. I'm sorry.
You're the film guy.
Amongst other things. Thank you.
Well, so we wanted it to be kind of a make that reference, but then we also there was quite kind of a literal reference in the sense that the project sprayed water from agricultural sprinkler heads from the tops of these giant tripods, which were supported.
Another orgasmic reference?
Yeah,
no?
I guess so. I suppose you could look at that.
I would.
Yes, exactly. They sprayed water from the tops of these tripods. There was another water element which periodically dumped water on your head, these kind of buckets.
At no particular timing.
At no particular time, yeah. So it was this kind of carnivalesque reference. The whole project was suggestive of a circus tent. So we wanted to kind of highlight the populism and the spectacle of these events in light of the fact that they were being sponsored by these high cultural institutions, kind of high culture meets the space of public pleasure.
Right.
We really wanted to make a space that felt like a nightclub, that felt like we really wanted to take the party idea and embrace it. So, you know, the project had big communal hammocks to hang out in. We're also dealing with kind of two types of craft in the project, one being a kind of digitally driven type of craft. We used a lot of technology from the sailing industry, and then the other being handcraft, more traditional forms of craft. And so there was a lot of, what would you call it, handwork in the project. I mean,
and, you know, we've been saying we, and I feel like I'm being a little bit unfair here. I should be asking you about your partner, Gaston Noguez.
Yeah.
And this collaboration began where?
We started working together in 2004 on a project in Silver Lake called Maximilian Schell at a gallery there called Materials and Applications.
Yes, I remember that. I remember that very well. It was a traffic stopper, very spectacular, and people could not, you know, it was a major kind of landmark in its time when it was there.
I suppose, yeah.
That's my perspective.
Yeah, I mean, we began working together on that project, and that project kind of codified an approach to design that we have since.
Well, two of you met. I'm sorry, you two of you had met during school.
Yeah,
yes?
We've known each other since probably 1990.
1990, and where were you guys at school?
Southern California Institute of Architecture.
SIARC. And so that dialogue began there.
It didn't really begin there because I think that we both went in separate directions after school. Neither of us really practiced architecture in any kind of traditional way. And neither of us practice architecture today in any kind of traditional way. But I'm not going to kid you into believing that that's the case. He went and worked for Frank Gehry and was really doing what I would kind of call creative fabrication, and solving a lot of design problems through a kind of hands-on engagement with materials at Gary's office. He's kind of the go-to person for that. And then I went and worked in the film industry as an art director, as a set designer, a production designer, and also worked for several artists.
You had some very interesting collaborators then, some of whom were like the Wachowski brothers. Well, there was Mark Romanek.
I wouldn't call these guys collaborators. I mean, I was working in their art departments. I mean, in various capacities. So, yeah, those were certainly influential experiences, mm-hmm. without a doubt. And I think that kind of, those experiences really carry over and inform the work that we're doing now. Because set design, like installation, like the kind of temporary works that we're doing today, the time frames are very similar, the logistics are very similar. The way that the work lives on as an image is similar. So that work had a lot of impact on what we're doing now.
How'd you find yourself in that world as opposed to something more sort of straightforward as an application for the background that you had?
Which world?
In the world of film.
When I finished school, there was a recession. And I had a really strong desire to design things and see them actualized, to make them. And it's going back to that discussion we were having about architecture. It's not built. Is not a building that's not built is not architecture, something like that. So I wanted to see.
So you're basically impatient.
I was impatient, right? I wanted to see things made, to actualize, see things
driven
built.
Might be a better word.
Yes, driven. And so film offered that opportunity. Film sets, event design. You know, I tried to get into theater. I did some things for musical or rock and roll tours. And so in a way, we're still kind of abiding by that ethos. We were looking for every opportunity that we can to make things and to actually build them in a recession economy when
here we are again
and no, the opportunities are few and far between. So when we get one, you know, even if it's designing a you know, an installation at a gallery in Silver Lake, we're going to use it as an opportunity to create, you know, something as extraordinary as we can.
And this seems to have its roots in your very earliest background. Your mother was in theater.
Mm.
You were exposed to that at a very early age.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
My mother was a theater director and an actress, so I was around backstage, the kind of mechanics of making a theatrical production quite a bit as a child. So to me, I could always see how a black box of a theater space could be transformed into something that a director wanted to use as a backdrop for a story, and very rapidly. And so that, I think, is something that has always been with me.
And it's never left you, really. It seems like it's still manifesting your work right now.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely. For sure.
And, you know, without...
Maybe it's not architecture, though. I don't know.
It's your own personal qualities mm-hmm. being manifested through architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about Gaston. I don't want you to speak for him, but tell me a little bit more about him.
He and I have different skills, although I think that our minds meet pretty squarely on the work that we're doing, like the aesthetic, the kind of overall concerns of the work we're creating right now. But we bring to the table a different sets of skills. So, for example, he's a master fabricator. He's been involved in fabrication or watched fabrication taking place since he was a little kid. His father was an aerospace engineer in Argentina and would take him to the factories where they're building airplanes. And so throughout high school, throughout SciArc, he's always been somebody who's really related to the world physically with his hands.
It's fascinating that both of you have those early, very early, very specific experiences that continue to inform your work to this day. That's a lovely privilege.
I guess so. You know, people will ask about, you know, how did your educational experience inform your work? And as I get older, I look back on my life, I see my childhood as being more important than my college.
It's almost as if your childhood influences wound up being catered to through your education, as opposed to being sort of influenced by the education itself.
I was influenced by my education, but I think that I just had a very strong urge to kind of use it in a way that, in hindsight, coincided with these interests that I developed as a child.
What are the goals and ambitions for you and Gaston?
We will, in the next several years, probably start building a lot more permanent works. I mean, we still don't really distinguish between, you know, we don't call ourselves artists, we don't really call ourselves architects, we're just kind of looking for these interesting opportunities to build. And so I see us making more permanent, probably public artworks. We'll probably do a lot of more pavilions that are temporary. We have a couple of buildings that are in the works. We are doing furniture. We're doing products. It's all over the map.
What's your website, by the way? For those who are listening, you should really check in and see what's going on.
www.ballnoguez.com. So it's
spell that, yes.
ballnoguez.com.
So if there's one thing that people don't know about you, what is it?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what people know about me.
Common misconception.
You know, with Facebook today, they know a lot more.
They know everything.
Than they used to know. I don't know. I like cats.
How does that inform your work?
A cat is a lot easier to attend to than the emotional needs of a person.
Well, there you go. So you're trans. Okay, you're admitting something about your age and your emotional disposition right now. So that is a lot of information.
There you go.
Excellent. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.